I'm Matt Katz, a reporter at WNYC, in for Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. Today, jury selection was delayed for the highly anticipated trial of Derek Chauvin, the officer accused of killing George Floyd last May. On Friday, just days before Chauvin's trial was to start, an appeals court ruled that Minnesota's attorney general could reinstate third-degree murder charges against Chauvin, who was already facing charges of second-degree murder and manslaughter. And now, the jury selection process has been delayed, pending the decision on the push for the third-degree murder charge. Last May, Chauvin pinned Floyd to the ground in a knee chokehold for about 9 minutes, as Floyd pleaded that he couldn't breathe. Footage of the incident sent shockwaves throughout Minneapolis and the nation at large. In the weeks and months that followed, protesters took to the streets in cities across the U.S., calling out police violence and systemic racism. As proceedings get underway, the city of Minneapolis is on edge as the community prepares for possible civil unrest like it saw last summer. Jury selection is expected to take several weeks. For more on what's happening in Minneapolis, we're joined now by Vice President of the Minneapolis City Council, Andrea Jenkins. Council Vice President, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you so much.
So let's get started with the latest news. On Friday, an appeals court ruled that the state's attorney general could reinstate these third-degree murder charges against Chauvin. Did that come as a surprise to you?
It actually did come as a bit of a surprise. It was... That request was denied initially by the judge. And so, you know, myself and I think many others thought that ship had sailed. But I think there was another case, the officer, former Minneapolis officer who was convicted of murder, had tried to appeal his case and appeal the third degree murder charge, and that appeal was denied. And so consequently, I think it set a precedent for the Chauvin case. So,
yeah. Is it important for you that this additional charge stick here in that he already is facing a more serious second degree murder charge? But the third degree, I guess, would also indicate just the severity of the alleged crime.
Yeah, I think it is important. Certainly, we want to make sure that we have enough charges so that something will be charged, something will be found guilty in this situation. But yeah, I think the community wants to see this charge as well. So I think it's a good move for the prosecutor.
There's a sense that an additional charge could guarantee, further guarantee a conviction or give a better chance for the prosecution to get a conviction here. Tensions are high right now in the city. Is the city anticipating protests like we saw last summer?
Well, we're certainly anticipating protests. I mean, there were a number of protests yesterday, I would say. Thousands of people all around the entire metro area. There are plans for protests today and all throughout the day. So there will be protests. I definitely don't anticipate them being as, you know, sort of violent and destructive as last summer. But yes, there will be protests.
Wanted to ask about what one of the things that came out of the events of last year. You, along with 8 other members of the Minneapolis City Council, signed a pledge to dismantle and defund the police department. That has not happened. Can you tell us what came of this remarkable promise that at the time garnered so much attention?
The process is still underway, Matt. I mean, it is it's not a simple feat. I would hope you would imagine that you just can't wake up one day and say, you know, that the police department is gone. It's a process. And so last summer, we, the council, put forth a charter change amendment. We have an independent charter commission that is appointed by a judge, and they determine what initiatives can go on the ballot. And so last last year after the murder of George Floyd and the subsequent promise, as you referred to it, took place in June. You know, there was simply a very short timeline in order to get that initiative through the process and on the ballot for November. And I think there was just a lot of confusion on the part of city residents around what the proposal actually meant. And so subsequently, it did not get on the 2021 ballot. There is an attempt to bring it again. Two of my colleagues have reintroduced that amendment to dismantle the police department and create a Office of Public Safety, which would be very similar to what we have at the state level, an Office of Public Safety, which includes our armed law enforcement or state troopers. And this new model would include a mental health process to help deal with issues that may not necessarily require an immediate police response. And we shifted some funds from that, from the Minneapolis Police Department to the Office of Violence Prevention, and to begin to set up that mental health response. So very much the process is underway, Matt.
So you envision there could be a time when Minneapolis revolutionizes the approach to policing and dismantles what we know now as a police department and moves functions to a totally different other entity? I mean, it's going to take time, but do you imagine that will happen in Minneapolis at some point?
Well, it's certainly, I am not a psychic. However, there's a lot of steps that has to happen before that can happen. And, you know, the 435,000 residents get to weigh in on that question. So, or hopefully they will get to, at this point, it's not even guaranteed that the item will be on the ballot. Yeah, I mean, I could see that happening.
And that's something
And let me be real clear. Yeah. That new reality, if it were to occur, would include professional, trained, hopefully highly accountable, and with community oversight, police department. So there will be armed law enforcement in the city of Minneapolis.
You are not abolishing the police, in other words. That is not the plan.
No.
What is the relationship right now between the Minneapolis Police Department and the public? Obviously, it's complicated and operates on many different levels, but are you able to characterize the state of that relationship now, particularly compared to last summer?
I would call it extremely fragile and fraught with mistrust and on both sides.
I imagine that's a major hurdle in trying to make either small or generational reforms to the police department.
It is. I certainly think the chief is absolutely amenable to and is calling for significant changes and making significant changes. So, you know, the chief is absolutely on board. The rank and file, you know, they continue to show up to their jobs every day. So I would like to think that they are really trying to make systemic change as well. But it is a highly contentious community right now. And I think, you know, many officers are feeling under attack. The community feels under attack. And it's a very tense situation.
Do you have any hopes from this trial? What would you like to see come out of this trial after it's over in terms of justice or solace for the people of Minneapolis, or anything else that you imagine would be a healing moment that could emanate from Chauvin's trial?
Well, first of all, I want to see justice for the Floyd family. I think that is the first and foremost goal that I have in mind. And justice in this situation would look like a conviction of former Officer Chauvin and the other officers, former officers involved, which I think will go a long way towards beginning the healing process in this community. But, you know, it's very clear to me that justice beyond justice in the criminal justice system is desired and deserved by this community, to the extent that, you know, prior to George Floyd being murdered, prior even to the pandemic, I had been, along with, you know, many, many community members, have been working for the past 3 years to develop what we call the 38th Street Thrive Plan. And as you may be familiar, the intersection where George Floyd was killed is 38th and Chicago. So we had been working on this small area plan to revitalize the community, to bring green jobs, to bring a center for racial healing, because we didn't just start having racial problems on May 25th. It's been a problem in the United States, an unaddressed problem in this country since 1619. And so we had a plan for developing a cultural center that focused on healing, that focused on uplifting the culture, and providing a space for reflection, for truth telling. You know, I initiated a truth and reconciliation process in this city so that we can begin to address the underlying causes of the systemic issues in our society. So there is a long-term plan to continue to pursue justice in various forms.
Andrea Jenkins is the Vice President of the Minneapolis City Council. Council Vice President Jenkins, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Matt.
We've been talking about the aftermath of George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis. Floyd's death didn't just spur calls for police reform there, but in cities and states across the U.S. So, where do things stand now? Here to walk us through the state of police reform in the U.S. is Jamiles Larte, staff writer at the Marshall Project. Jamiles, glad to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, I want to start with the latest from Congress. Last week, the House passed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. Is this noteworthy in and of itself, even though, you know, it hasn't passed in the Senate yet? What is the significance of just the vote itself, and what does the bill do?
Sure. I think that's a yes and no question, right? I mean, on one level, it is a pretty dramatic piece of legislation in terms of addressing policing. On the other hand, it was passed last year in the House and wasn't taken up by the Senate, and it seems fairly unlikely to gain traction in the Senate this session. I mean, the Democrats would need to keep the entire party together on this question, which isn't a guarantee, and then would need to get 10 Republicans to join them in promoting this bill. And it seems like the qualified immunity portion of the bill is going to really just make that impossible.
The effort to eliminate qualified immunity,
or yeah,
to
correct,
scale it back. Yeah. In the weeks and months following the killing of George Floyd, states all over the country rushed to pass their own police reform bills. Do we have a sense of how many of those actually became law?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I would caution against sort of trying to come up with hard numbers, because all of these states are starting from different places in terms of what's the law in the books. And then the laws that were proposed and, you know, either passed or failed, all had different components to them, right? So it's difficult or maybe unwise to kind of group them all together and say, you know, these are all the places that passed bills. I'd say Colorado probably went the furthest of all the states that were able to pass bills because they did address this question of qualified immunity. And, you know, for listeners who may be unfamiliar with the term, that's a legal doctrine that says effectively that government workers can't be held liable for what they do on the job, except in rare circumstances. It's a doctrine that was judicially created in the 1960s and has been slowly but surely expanded by courts in the meanwhile. I think another thing that we see in the laws that have passed in the wake of George Floyd's death is they kind of come of a few different varieties, and many states kind of bundled all of these things together. But there are laws that are inspired by the death of Breonna Taylor that address no-knock raids. There are laws that were inspired by the death of George Floyd that often touched on banning chokeholds or carotid restraint. And more generally, many of these laws have endeavored to address kind of broader systemic policing things like qualified immunity, which sort of speaks to whether the difficulty in holding police officers accountable and I guess in some respects personally liable for their mm-hmm. actions on the job.
And what about defunding the police? Has that call translated into policy or budget moves of any significance anywhere around the country?
I think probably what's more reasonable to say is that the pandemic has had the effect of defunding local government, which has included the police, right? So many municipalities have seen their tax base really wither and crumble in the loss of sales tax and, you know, all different ways that governments fund themselves. So, you know, to give you an example, I live in New Orleans, and here our police budget is being cut to the point where officers are under a mandatory over a month of furlough. They've got to take, I think, 26 unpaid days off next year just to try to cover some of the budget shortfall. So we're seeing that in cities around the country much more than we're seeing the actual sort of implementation of defund. What we certainly are seeing in a lot of places is experimentation, pilot programs to use this term, unbundle the police, right? To take some of the activities that police currently do or some of the situations that police currently respond to and to offload those to civilian agencies, folks who don't carry guns. We have seen a fair degree of that. That is not always necessarily tied to changes in funding, which have to happen as a matter of legislation and have to sort of go through a process.
What are some of the challenges that those who want more radical changes to police departments are facing? Is it police unions that are the major obstacle?
Police unions are certainly an obstacle, or maybe to be more specific, police union contracts are an mm-hmm. obstacle because there's many changes that have been proposed and that, quite honestly, a lot of police chiefs would be open to, but the union contract, which only comes up every so many years, it prevents those types of reforms from being implemented. So that's certainly a large piece standing in the way. I think more broadly, what's standing in the way of reforms or of reimagining or any, you know, whichever term you want to use, is just the inertia of the system, right? The system has grown and developed over many, many years to be this way. And it's very hard to turn that kind of thing around.
Jamiles Larte is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. Jamiles, thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So now we turn to you. Last year, we heard from many of you of your participation in the George Floyd protests. Now, nearly 1 year later, as we see the trial for Officer Derek Chauvin coming up, we hear from you again on whether you have continued to be involved and what you hope for in terms of police reform.
Hey, this is Joel from Bremerton, Washington. I would like to see any officer who is forced to use deadly force removed from his job and never be able to be any type of cop ever again. We just can't have police out there with kill records. I would also like to be able to see a cop's disciplinary record every time there is an incident. I'm not aware of any tangible police reforms in Texas, or at least in Dallas, where I live. I'd like to see no-knock warrants banned, chokeholds banned, use of deadly force against unarmed suspects prosecuted, not only banned, but prosecuted the same way that persons not on the police force would be prosecuted. That's, in my opinion, that's murder. That's not self-defense like police would like to claim.
I'm not aware of any police reform in my own small rural town, but in the broader community and nearby municipalities, I would love to see a plan or policy that doesn't automatically send armed officers with weapons drawn to any unusual situation. In many cases, dispatching social workers would be much more effective.
This is Lou in Falmouth, Massachusetts on Cape Cod. I've been involved with protests against police brutality, especially after George Floyd's and many other murders. I'm still engaged, and what I want to see is a major reallocation of funding away from policing to other services and resources that have a much greater long-term impact on crime, on civil unrest, the peace, and social, emotional, and physical safety and well-being.
This is Simon Spanton in Gilbert, Arizona. After the savage killing of George Floyd and others, the reforms I'd like to see are threefold. One, chokehold deaths are homicide, period. Two, no policing of blacks by whites. There are too many bad apples in uniform. And three, until two is in place, either party should have the right to summon an independent third party to referee the interaction between them.
I am Vanessa Walker of St. Simons Island, Georgia. My 18-year-old daughter and I protested the injustice system in our community in Glynn County, Georgia last year. This is where Ahmaud Arbery was shot down by the son of a retired officer of the local district attorney's office. Our demonstrations were peaceful but direct and focused. We had twin goals of seeking justice for Arbery's death and accountability of the DA. A diverse group of citizens worked to register new voters, demand justice, and change in the system. We successfully elected a write-in candidate to defeat the incumbent DA. I'm relocating to Atlanta with a dream of working with Stacey Abrams to improve voter rights and preserve enfranchisement. With the onslaught of proposed legislation to curtail voting rights, now is a critical time to pay attention and act to keep including all legal voters. To me, this is the clearest path to an improved, responsive, and inclusive country for every one of us.
My name is Pam Graber. I'm calling from Sebastopol, California. Yes, I have attended some protest regarding that brutality. And yes, I am on a white allyship journey. It was inspired by the 28-day exercise found in the book Me and White Supremacy.
Thank you for calling us. Remember, you can always call in to 877-8-MY-TAKE and share your thoughts or record a voice memo and email it to us at takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
On this week's On the Media, what happened to the offbeat, irreverent, speaking truth to power alt weeklies that used to populate newsstands across the country?
The Voice was your guide to life from people who cared about what they were covering with such intensity that there were fistfights and brawls inside the paper. That's gone.
The end of an era on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
And the first pitch to Tatis is launched to deep left field. Slam Diego has come to Arizona. And Tatis, a no-doubter, way up on the berm in left. And the Padres have themselves a 5-run second inning against the Diamondbacks.
After a very unusual 2020 season, Major League Baseball is back this spring, and things will actually look a little more like what fans are used to. Teams are expecting to play a full 162 games, and designated hitters will no longer be stepping in for pitchers in the National League. Most stadiums are also expecting to welcome back crowds at a limited capacity. And while we'll have to wait and see how the season goes from a public health standpoint, the MLB has also had to contend this offseason with several reports alleging sexual harassment by coaches toward female reporters and personnel. The league has announced overhauls to its harassment policies as a result, but whether teams are actually committed to changing a sexist culture remains to be seen. Here with me now is Hannah Kaiser, national baseball writer for Yahoo Sports. Thanks for being here, Hannah.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So spring training just kicked off and you're not there covering it in person from what I understand, but just very curious, how are things looking to you from a distance so far?
Well, I wish I was there covering in person. That's one of the ways that it's looking to me. It's looking warm, which I wish I could be there.
You're stuck up in New York. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm stuck in New York in part because while some of the things are different from last year in terms of the protocols, one of the things that remains the same is there is no reporter access in the clubhouses. So that's why I'm not there. It's looking exciting. There's been a surprising number of grand slams that you guys let off with a sound from Fernando Tatis Jr.'s. And since then, both Pete Alonso for the Mets and Brett Gardner for the Yankees have hit grand slams. So, which I think, you know, it's spring, so it doesn't mean anything except that it means that people in New York are going to be very excited and lucky to have probably two really good teams this year.
Oh, that's good news. Speaking as a Mets fan, that's great news for me. And who doesn't love a grand slam in general? Most exciting play in baseball. Let's talk about the public health situation as it involves this current season. What protocols will be in place to prevent COVID outbreaks among players and staff?
Oof, I don't think we have time to get through all of them because I'm looking at a 108-page 2021 operations manual. If you watched last year's 60-game season, it's a lot of the same protocols. So in negotiating these protocols, the league and the union started from a place of what they had last year, and not just what they started last year with, but what they sort of developed over the course of the season. That includes, you know, masks and social distancing and really, really elaborate this massive document includes these like really elaborate diagrams of where people should be on the field for every drill. So they've really thought through everything. Like in terms of if you're doing first and third drills, where should everyone on the field be to sort of social distance? So it's incredibly thorough. There are some changes from last year. Probably most notably is that they have sort of ramped up sanctions for players who break protocol. So that we haven't seen specific sanctions yet, but we have seen players already sort of forced into isolation. Forced is maybe too strong a word because the players came forward, but a couple of players on the Indians are isolating right now after breaking COVID-19 protocols because there is sort of a stricter overview. Like their guys, they're wearing these like monitor bracelets that the NBA wore. So the big update is sort of just that, you know, rather than just asking people to do this, they're really taking it seriously and it lays out room for punishment. So hopefully that'll mean everyone is even safer because there were a fair number of outbreaks, especially at the start of last season.
Hannah, there were some significant rule changes in the shortened 2020 season, and originally the league wanted to keep some of those rules, but the players' union rejected their proposal. What were those rules, and why were the players against it?
I don't know that the players were against the rules so much. In fact, there were rule changes that the players wanted that the league rejected. That would be the designated hitter in both leagues. So some of the rules are back, most notably seven-inning doubleheaders and the runner on second in extra innings, my least favorite of every rule.
Me too. I hate that.
It's so arbitrary. Are both back as sort of safety measures. So those were included in sort of these health and safety protocols, sort of allowing for the possibility that games might need to get rescheduled if there is, for instance, an outbreak. We saw 45 games rescheduled during the 60-game season last year, not 45 of 60, but 45 of all the team's games. And so rescheduled games is a real possibility, which is why both sides agreed to the seven-inning doubleheader and this extra runner on second base in extra innings to keep games from getting way too long. They did not agree. The big sort of hang-up in the labor negotiations this year was between the designated hitter in the National League, which they had last year, and which will almost certainly be back in the next CBA when it gets renegotiated this offseason. So the designated hitter not in, and then neither do we have the expanded postseason that we had last year. So last year, on opening day, it was kind of crazy. They announced that there would be a huge postseason field. I think it was 16 teams, more than half, bigger than it's ever been before. And the league wanted that. They wanted that for the sort of very obvious, very literal reason. More postseason teams means more playoff games, means more postseason revenue, because playoff games are worth way more than regular season games from like a broadcast perspective. So the league really wanted that to recoup some of their losses. Everybody took hits economically in a pandemic year. And the players want the designated hitter. It creates another valuable role. So another 15 designated hitters means 15 power hitting guys who are more likely to get big deals because they don't have to sort of accommodate their maybe, you know, liable defense. And there was a huge sort of standoff between these two sides. And the end result is it doesn't look like we're going to get either of those things. Now, like I said, we're going to renegotiate the entire CBA next offseason. So probably some version of both of those things is still coming, but they really kind of stuck it to each other this year by not giving in on the thing that both sides wanted.
Right. And a point of clarification for any soccer, basketball, non-baseball fans listening, designated hitter means that the pitcher generally doesn't bat, and there's another offensive player in the mix. So just wanted to sneak that in there for those who weren't familiar. Want to talk a little bit about non-baseball related baseball issues. This season, reporters uncovered allegations of sexual harassment that resulted in the firing of Mets general manager Jared Porter and the suspension of Angels pitching coach Mickey Callaway. For people who haven't been following, what was detailed in those reports and what were the ramifications?
Well, perhaps most importantly, what was detailed in those reports was a pattern of behavior that stretched back prior to both of the jobs that they have now. Both of those guys are in brand new jobs. Jared Porter was hired by the Mets this offseason. Mickey Callaway, I'm going to forget if it was this offseason or last year. But those are new jobs for both of those guys. And the reports detailed allegations almost primarily from previous jobs. So Mickey Callaway back from when he was manager of the Mets, Jared Porter from when he was with the Cubs. And so what came to light was, you know, this pattern of behavior of harassing reporters. Jared Porter in particular, it was one reporter, a woman from a different country who didn't speak English that well. And so it was like a real abuse of power. And Mickey Callaway, it was like a slightly different sort of, you know, a pattern of inappropriate text messages to female reporters. And in both cases, what you're seeing is that there's not just a sexual harassment angle, but there is this real trap of if you are a female reporter, you want to talk to these people and you want them to reach out to you. And the Jared Porter one in particular, the ESPN got these text messages, these really outrageous text messages. And most troublingly to me was that sort of in the course of sending this woman dozens of unresponded to text messages, Jared Porter suddenly dangled trade news and in exchange for meeting him for a drink, which you know, obviously puts this woman in a horrible position. She didn't respond ever, and he eventually ended up sending her a nude photo. But, you know, it's a really difficult position because it puts you at a professional liability. You know, if Jared Porter's going to tell somebody that trade news, and if it could be you and it's not, if you're a female reporter, now, even if you're sort of unwilling to engage with that, you are taking the professional hit. And I think that's something that MLB, you know, even in they fired Jared Porter and Mickey Callaway is under investigation. I don't know why this investigation is taking so long. It's sort of still technically getting investigated. But even if both of these men lose their jobs, which they should and which they likely will, we're still left with a situation in which almost virtually every man in the industry sort of has information that women want and that female reporters need to gain access to, and figuring out a way to sort of make those relationships tenable and productive without like getting, you know, tipping over. It's not enough to sort of say, well, you shouldn't talk, you shouldn't text women after hours because women are going to be texting you. They have
the job, right? Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So I think that's something that it feels like MLB is not right now. We're still in sort of weeding out bad men, which could take a long time because baseball hasn't really had quite the same reckoning that has happened in a lot of other industries. But what it's going to look like on the other side, I don't really know.
We got about 30 seconds left, but I'm just wondering if any teams have announced overhauls to their harassment policies. Has this prompted a bit of change?
MLB announced an overhaul, but it involves, you know, like a third party helpline or hotline that you can call. Teams are trying to take it seriously. I've been talking to general managers this whole spring, and you know, they tell me that they're talking to their teams about it. When Sandy Alderson had a press conference following the Jared Porter firing, I asked him, did you speak to any women? Because they said, we had no idea. We had no, you know, everyone gave him such glowing reviews. And I said, did anyone who gave him a glowing review, did you speak to any women? And he said, no. But he said that was because there were no women in positions of power to talk to. And that's probably true, which is its own issue.
Right.
But I think when it comes to sort of rooting this behavior out, we need to look not just at the people in power, but the people they have power over.
Hannah Kaiser is a national baseball writer for Yahoo Sports. Thanks so much, Hannah.
Thanks for having me.
Last night, Oprah's highly anticipated interview with Meghan Markle and Prince Harry about their decision to leave the royal family last year aired on CBS.
When I was pregnant, all around this same time, so we have in tandem the conversation of he won't be given security, he's not going to be given a title, and also concerns and conversations about how dark his skin might be when he's born.
Markle faced harsh criticism even before the interview ran because of accusations of bullying and the timing of the interview's release. And 99-year-old patriarch Prince Philip is currently still in the hospital following a heart procedure. But Meghan and Harry spent most of the discussion giving their side of the tabloid stories that have circulated, and they revealed some shocking details. They alleged that there were royal conversations about how dark their child's skin would be, rifts within the family, and even mental health issues Meghan struggled with. Here with us to discuss all of this is Kristen Meinzer, a royal watcher, podcaster, and author of How to Be Fine. Kristen, welcome.
Hi, Matt.
All right, Kristen, so I just first want to get your overall reaction to the interview yesterday and if there was anything that surprised you more than anything else.
Oh my gosh, there's so much to say about this interview. I think what I was mostly surprised by was how forthcoming Meghan and Harry were about all sorts of things that normally they would have to be buttoned up about. For example, I didn't expect either of them to name names at any point. Meghan, very early on in the interview, actually set the record straight about something with her sister-in-law, Kate, and I wasn't expecting that. So yeah, I absolutely was surprised at many moments, and I even cried watching some of this.
Wow, what touched you? What made you cry or upset you?
Well, I think that we all knew that Meghan was going through a very tough time there. She was being attacked with racist media stories, misogynistic media stories. We know that she wasn't being protected. We know the firm was not setting the record straight. When I say the firm, I mean the business side of the royal family was not setting the record straight. And, you know, I think that was obvious from the outside, but we had no idea of how unprotected she felt, how lonely she felt, how much they were keeping her behind palace walls all the time. And we had no idea that she was suicidal. And she talks very frankly about that, how she thought things would be better if she just weren't alive anymore. And fortunately, Harry provided solace for her. She leaned on one of Princess Diana's old friends. But when she went to the firm, they refused to help her. They said it would not be a good look.
They refused to help her, like getting her mental health treatment or anything of the like, right?
Yes, exactly.
Specifically as it relates to racist treatment, which is something that came up again and again in this interview, for Meghan as a woman of mixed race background, what revelations did she and Harry reveal about how the palace treated her because of her race?
Ooh, there were some big bombshells in there. Mostly, Harry said that he had some learning to do about race, because it's one thing to read about race or to have friends of color, but to be married to Meghan and to be the father now of a child of color, he had a lot of learning to do, and he said his family is not really up on all of that learning. And one example they gave is that the whole family, or the firm, I should say, was very concerned about what color will Archie's skin be when he's born. And there were major concerns. What will it look like? What will people think? What if he's too dark? And they didn't say that directly to Meghan, but Harry confirmed they made that clear to him, and they would not name names of who specifically was voicing those concerns, but those concerns were very real.
You said earlier that Meghan set the record straight about her and what she's had to deal with and what the major story was about her sister-in-law. Can you explain a little bit about that, like what that story was about and how she set the record straight?
Yes, yes. Well, there have been a number of stories in the UK tabloid press trying to pit these two women against each other, because tabloids love a story where one person gets to be the hero and one gets to be the villain, and they've often set Meghan up as the villain. And one story that got repeated over and over and over again was that Meghan, in the lead up to her wedding, was a bridezilla, that she made Kate cry, that she was being a tyrant about the bridesmaids' dresses. And that was repeated in so many outlets. And Meghan set the record straight and said it was actually the other way around. But Kate was very apologetic. Kate sent me flowers and a note. She did all the things I would have done if I hurt someone's feelings. And I forgave her. And I don't think that, you know, Kate would necessarily want this falsehood out there, but it never got corrected. So she corrected it herself last night.
Wow. Who were they blaming here for both the racism that they felt subtly and not so subtly, and then the misinformation, the disinformation that showed up in the British tabloids? They repeated the fact that they have a good relationship with the Queen. Both of them said that repeatedly, that all's good with the Queen, but it's the firm, the institution, the palace that were often blamed. But the Queen runs the palace, right, or not? I was a little struck by that watching. I'm like, wait, whose fault is this really?
Well, we have to also keep in mind there's a difference between the family and the firm. The family is who you get together with on the holidays and open presents with and so on. And the firm is the company. It's the PR image. It is everything that you see when they're on the balcony waving at the crowds. And so, you know, the firm is more than just the Queen. And as far as the firm perpetuating the racist news coverage and so on, they were not issuing corrections when they could have. 70 MPs actually said that the misogynistic and racist treatment of Meghan should stop now. It is unacceptable. So even members of the government were speaking out about this. And why wouldn't the firm? So when you ask whose fault is it that this continued, a lot of it is the firm and their decision not to set the record straight. They would set the record straight on very minor stories, very inconsequential ones, but they wouldn't set the story straight on stories that threw Meghan under the bus or stories that were outright racist. So they could have, but they didn't. And Harry made it very clear it's because the royal family is actually afraid of the press.
Who makes that decision then, if not the Queen, about what stories to push back on, how to handle the PR? Are you indicating that there's almost like a bureaucracy, like a deep state, if you will, within the palace that almost has more control than the Queen, at least when it comes to managing the family's public image?
Well, remember, it's not just the queen here. We have the future king, her son Charles. We have the next future king, William. And Harry made it very clear in the interview at one point, Charles stopped taking his phone calls and things are very rough between the two right now. And they're working very hard right now, William and Harry, to eventually be close again. But right now they're not close.
Wow. And explain to us the situation with the finances and how Harry talked about how his security was suddenly cut off.
Yeah. So they were cut off over a year ago in early 2020. And Harry said very pointedly, he had no dreams of being a media superstar. He had no plans of making a deal with Netflix or with Spotify. And a lot of the tabloids, they print that story and say, oh, look, Meghan and Harry were opportunistic all along. They just wanted to be celebrities. But Harry made clear, we only made those deals because we were cut off financially. There was no security team for us. And everybody knew where we lived because the tabloids kept printing it. And we have a baby here. We need protection. And how are we going to pay for that security? So they took those Netflix deals, the Spotify deal, and so on. But also Harry made very clear, I had to rely heavily on my inheritance from my mother. And sometimes I think, maybe my mother knew what was going to happen. That was a very touching part of the interview.
Yeah, it was quite chilling, really. What do you make of the Princess Diana situation and her life and the end of her life, and then any similarities to this situation?
Oh, there are so many similarities. The feeling of being constantly chased, of being trapped, the admissions of mental anguish that both Harry and Meghan expressed in this interview. Both of them felt a great deal of anguish, and Harry said himself that he did not want history repeating itself, and we know what happened to Princess Diana, and obviously he didn't want that to happen to his wife, too. So there were a lot of echoes of that very famous interview that Princess Diana gave in 1995. I felt the echoes of that, and I just hope that these two have a much better outcome than Diana did.
You know, even for non-royal families, a lot of our listeners might be able to relate to parts of this story about family expectations and the feeling of belonging when you marry into a family, and then the tears that can sometimes happen around weddings over things like bridesmaid dresses. I'm wondering what sort of larger themes you might have seen. Like, how did this interview explore just basic family dynamics and what it's like to navigate a life on your own terms when you're sort of starting out on creating your own family?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of like a lot of those dynamics turned up to 11 if your new in-laws were actually a corporation and not just individuals. I kind of feel like it was like that, actually.
Yeah.
But
right.
Yeah, there's absolutely references in the Oprah interview to what members of the family were most welcoming. They were very, very, very welcomed by the queen from the get-go, which family members maybe a little bit less so as time went on. You know, I was very relieved to hear that most of the family was incredibly welcoming to Meghan in the beginning. But, you know, as things went on, it sounds like the queen continued to be the most welcoming and the other members of the family less so. And I think we all know families like that, where maybe there's one member of the family that does their best to make sure you're feeling okay and comfortable and welcome, and then maybe some other people are not.
Right, right. What came of the allegations that Meghan Markle bullied her staff at the palace? And were those allegations addressed at all last night?
No, that was not discussed. And let's remember, those allegations did not come out until it was announced that the Oprah interview was going to happen. The Oprah interview was taped about a month ago, I believe. And so this was, you know, in some people's opinions, an attempt by the press or by the royal family to take attention away from Meghan and Harry's story or to damage their legitimacy. But no, that was not addressed. What was addressed was that there were a lot of, you know, stories that were probably coming from inside the palace.
Right, right. You know, you yourself have brushed up against racism in British media firsthand. I want to play a clip of you being interviewed by Piers Morgan on Good Morning Britain.
Calling Meghan Markle straight out of Compton, which is clearly trying to make an allusion to her being a, a gangster, and very specifically a black gangster.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't actually.
Did you read the whole article? Comparing her to a jihadist. Why would she be a jihadist because she was working on a charitable cookbook? That is racist.
Yeah, but you
that
see, is this unacceptable. This is the narrative.
And who would not want to escape that abuse, Pierce?
Well, I'm sure we're going to hear all this when we see the Oprah Winfrey. It'll all be skewed.
Kristen, can you explain what happened there?
Yes, that was a good time. Piers Morgan asked me to give very specific examples of racism, and I want to note I am a woman of color, and he was asking me, a woman of color, to give examples of racism against a woman of color, Meghan Markle, fellow American. And as I tried to explain that to him and give very clear examples, he talked over me the whole time, so you could barely hear what I was saying. But I would say that is pretty racist. Ask a woman of color to explain some racist examples and then talk over her the whole time.
So interesting. I mean, you have a woman from the United States, a woman with both black and white background, becoming a princess in the UK. And then through her, we're getting a sense of racism in the media and the culture in the UK, right?
Well, I really don't want to say it's, you know, the entire UK. We certainly have our issues and challenges with racism right here at home. But I would say that the UK tabloid press certainly has challenges here, and the royal family does.
Yeah. Wanted to ask you just an overall picture about the monarchy itself before I let you go. There are some critics who question why we even still have, or why Britain still has, this monarchy at all. Do you think this increased spotlight on the royal family is making people question the existence of the monarchy itself more so than they would have previously?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I can say all over the Twitterverse, on social media, so many people that I follow in the world right now are essentially saying, you know, why do we need this? And what is the point? And, you know, I've heard this before. I've been covering the royals now for over 10 years, and I've heard over and over again, like, oh, they're being paid tax dollars to live in castles and so on. But I think that this conversation with Meghan and Harry pushed things further, because it's not just that they're living off of tax dollars and castles and wearing billions of dollars of jewelry and whatnot. It's that they're hurting people on the inside. And I think that is going to really ruffle a lot of feathers.
Kristen Meinzer is a podcaster, royal watcher, and author of How to Be Fine. Kristen, thank you so much for watching this for us and giving us a breakdown. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Matt.
And that's all for our show today, folks. It's always a pleasure being here with you guys. I'll be in all week, so be sure to tune in. And of course, call us if you have any thoughts or show ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also shoot me a tweet. I'm at MattKatz00. You could also record a voice memo on your phone and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. More tomorrow.